Hello and welcome to the third and final episode in our mini podcast series where we've been looking at the changes to unfair dismissal, which will be coming in courtesy of the Employment Rights Act 2025. So that is the reduction in the qualifying period from 2 years to 6 months and the removal of the compensation cap. My name is Kate Redshaw and I'm in the employment team at Burgess Salmon. And in today's episode, we're going to be looking at the impact of the removal of the compensation cap for employers and what that means in relation to high-risk dismissals and also in relation to your strategy for negotiating settlement agreements. And joining me today for the discussion is my regular partner in crime, Katie Wooler. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you doing?
And I'm very good. Thank you for asking. And I'm really very excited to be joined by Luke Berry, who is our head of department. Hi, Luke. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know you've been clamoring to be on this podcast, absolutely. Luke. So, you know, no mercy for you. I'm going to start the first question. So we know from tribunal statistics that actually, although the cap is being removed, the average award, the average median award in a tribunal claim for unfair dismissal is £6,746. So in other words, way, way below the maximum that a tribunal could award now, which is 52 weeks pay or 123 and just about 123,500 or thereabouts pounds, whichever is the lower. So already we're looking at very, very few claims reaching that cap. So at risk of quashing this podcast at the first blow, is the removal of the compensation cap actually going to make any difference on the ground?
Not sure I'd have got the call up if it wasn't.
Yeah, it's very brief episode.
Indeed. But you do make a good point. I think it is important to put the cap into context. We're not suddenly going to have all unfair dismissal claims being high value. As you say, the vast majority of claims for ordinary unfair dismissal come well below the current cap, and that will continue to be the case. And I think that is a point the government have continued to stress throughout this on repeated occasions. However, before our viewers sort of turn off, my view is that there will be a larger number of claims which will bust the cap. And I think perhaps more importantly, there are going to be various groups of people who will think now more seriously about bringing ordinary unfair dismissal claims than they would have done to date. And that's because the sort of risk reward profile is going to change significantly with the removal of the cap.
Yeah. Okay. So what sort of, I suppose, if we call those high risk dismissals for the sake of argument, who do you think, what sort of types of employee claim would fall into that? Where should employers be on the lookout?
In addition to Premier League footballers, you know.
Yeah, there's been a lot of slight obsession about that, hasn't there, where this has been covered?
Well,
true. Very true. I'd forgotten. Is it right said forgotten about the World Cup? Probably. That's probably not me being in touch with what's happening, is it? Anyway, Luke, to bring this back to some order, apart from Premier League footballers, who else do we think employers might need to be?
So obvious one, high earners, senior execs, those with remuneration packages, including sort of significant bonuses, other incentives, you know, bonus, equity, deferred comp, etc. In some of those cases, real high earners could be busting the compensatory cap with a number of weeks or months salary. I think the ones to think about a bit more, though, maybe slightly less obvious, are those with maybe lower base salary, but significant benefit packages. So think public sector, final salary, pensions. If they get dismissed unfairly, going to be difficult to replicate those level of benefits. So ongoing losses. And the other group I think you really need to think about are those who could point to a sustained period of loss following unfair dismissal. So, you know, for example, someone dismissed for conduct in a regulated sector or perhaps.
So is that what you're thinking, like career long?
Well, indeed. It'd be much harder for them to go and get commensurate employment because of that record. The other group for me would be your sort of older or perhaps disabled employees who can legitimately say, it may well take me longer to go and mitigate my loss. So unlike now, in those circumstances, if the losses go well beyond a year, a tribunal will be able to make awards which truly reflect their losses. And I think just one other sting in the tail, don't want to be too too negative. That's probably me.
Welcome to the podcast.
Don't forget the ACAS award uplift.
Yes, so fair point.
Failure to comply with the code in disciplinary performance grievance cases. Award can be increased by up to 25%. If you're talking uncapped compensation, those numbers can get quite big quite quickly.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
those are the sorts of groups of people I think employers should be thinking about.
Yeah. No, all very valid points. Katie, time to bring you in here. I think you've been sitting there
ready
and waiting. So if I'm an employer trying to agree a settlement, mm-hmm. And we'll talk about the logistics of that in a little bit, but or if an employee's taken me to tribunal, has brought a claim and I'm trying to settle that claim, mm-hmm. what sort of things would an employer try to take into account when working out what actually might be a fair package?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is all of these will be quite familiar principles that that our listeners and an audience will have come across before. What's changing, I guess, is quite how significant some of these points will be, mm. Essentially because the stakes are going to be higher. So as we've said at the outset, how a tribunal calculates loss of earnings isn't going to change. They're still going to be looking at the date of dismissal and then the loss of earnings from that point up until either the individual obtains commensurate employment or ought to have done. But once they've got to that figure, there may well be some different sort of mechanisms to reduce that amount. I suspect this term will be quite a familiar one. There's probably one of the most common is called a Polkey reduction, which is where a tribunal will look at the likelihood that the employee will have got to a fair dismissal anyway, if it had gone through the process fairly.
That's the case, isn't it? Polkey and Dayton Services.
Good knowledge.
Indeed, that's quite an old case.
But yeah, that's based on a case where, it can come up quite often in a performance context. And we've talked about performance, obviously, in light of the unfair dismissal reforms quite a lot. So the idea being that if an employer had gone through perhaps a performance process where they'd established that performance just wasn't up to scratch, but they hadn't gone through the full process, they perhaps hadn't given sufficient time, a tribunal may come in and say, well, we're comfortable that you established that capability is the reason for dismissal, but really the process you should have given longer to improve.
Satisfied that fair reason for dismissal,
yes,
that your process is wanting.
Yeah, and that's the assessment the tribunal's got to make. It's got to say, had you carried out a fair process, would you have got to the same outcome? If you would, what would the compensation be? So the compensation in that case could be pay for the 2 months that you should have extended the performance process by. So it's quite a complicated fact specifics analysis, but it's a useful one. Another one to mention is only really relevant in misconduct cases typically, but is contributory fault.
Mm-hmm.
So if the individual is in some way sort of culpable or blameworthy, and that has to link to the dismissal, so there has to be sort of related conduct, and a tribunal could make a reduction in the compensatory award to reflect that, of anything between 0% and 100%. So that'll be one that I think we'll see coming up quite a lot more often. And then the other one I was going to mention is in relation to things like bonuses. That's kind of quite a specific one, but I think there's going to be a lot more argument around the employee saying, well, I would have earned this bonus. And then the employer saying, well, in the circumstances, we'd have exercised our discretion not to,
mm-hmm.
Or we would rely on this term or that term in our bonus or bonus policy to say that it's not payable or it's payable at this lower level. And like that really undermines the importance of making sure you've got your docs in a good place to be able to bring those arguments.
I agree with all of that, but continuing my glass half empty theme.
I didn't know you had that approach.
my take is, particularly with senior exits, they are inevitably going to become more complicated, more protracted, because I think the balance of power, there's going to have been a shift. Employees can point to no compensatory cap and say that needs to be taken into account. So I think employers need to think about all those points, but I also think they need to be reconsidering their sort of open positions, how they're going to get to exit points, how they're going to be in as strong a position as possible to negotiate deals.
Yeah.
And that may well be laying down some groundwork in terms of performance processes management that they can actually rely on to say, if you don't do the deal, there could be a fair dismissal.
Mm. Yeah, because I guess the issue with the various of the points I've just mentioned is they all can be a bit complex and take a bit of time. So in terms of that speedy negotiation, they're going to be, there might be points you raise, but they'll be more helpful further down the line. But in the short term, it will make negotiations a bit harder.
And or points you'd be making at a remedies hearing later down the line, exactly, as opposed to in the midst of battle trying to negotiate some sort of deal.
Yeah, and I suppose if you don't have those guardrails in place once that compensation cap has gone, I mean, the difficulty we've had, and particularly if you take into account that in some parts of the country, tribunal delays are pretty significant. If you've got one of your high-risk dismissal categories, Luke, so you're senior, your chief exec, or your older person who has not been able to mitigate their loss by getting another job. And let's face it, for somebody like a chief exec, if they've been dismissed for poor performance, it's going to be pretty difficult for that person to replace their income. Or, you know, they can show that they've made reasonable attempts to mitigate their losses by getting another job. It's going to be quite difficult to do that. I mean, I suppose, what are your kind of thoughts on how you might bring down those settlement negotiations there?
Well, I think there's lots of preemptive steps you should be taking. Let's not forget, put it into context, that it's only a small number or specific groups of people. The point we made at the start, that it's not going to apply in every unfair dismissal scenario. But when you're looking at senior execs, there's some obvious points. And I know you've covered some of these in previous episodes without me. Obviously,
they weren't as good, Luke. They were not as good.
Recruitment's an obvious one. It sounds trite, but I do see much more onus being placed on your due diligence of hires, particularly senior hires, more so than maybe today. And again, another obvious point: relevant manager training and consistency of approach across your business. You know, inconsistency is one you constantly see people trip up on. Thirdly, just honing in a bit more on sort of senior execs would be a review of your sort of service agreements and remuneration packages to make sure that they've got as much contractual protection as you can afford, appreciating it's going to be a commercial balance between wanting to get the right people and incentivizing them to join. Alongside that, just thinking about your governance and authorization trails for the granting of awards, who's doing it, when they're doing it. I think probably hasn't happened as much as it should to date, but really thinking and documenting what a role looks like and what successful performance of a role looks like. So clearer, more objective performance metrics, going again in offer letters, contracts, but throughout conversations and employment. Aligned to that, the obvious one, which I think will be fascinating to see how it plays out, is how you are actually going to effectively performance manage or assess performance for senior hires. Who's going to do it? What's it going to look like? But those first 6 months, as we've discussed, are going to be key in assessing whether you've got the right hire, is it the right cultural fit, etc. But even beyond that, as I've mentioned, you know, more detailed paper trails, more thorough performance processes, if that's appropriate, to try and give yourself a better open position to potentially justify a dismissal, or alternatively, they'd be able to go into those settlement discussions with a stronger foothold. And I guess final point, just thinking it through, would be a bit of upskilling of your teams as to how tribunals assess awards. You know, you've got just that headline, no cap. You've got AI telling you, no cap, go for glory, give everything. You know, unexpected, maybe, expectations from employees as to what they might get. So if you can talk cogently about how tribunals assess compensatory awards, how they bring them down, as Katie was discussing, I think that'd be a useful investment of time. It's going to put you in a much better place to have those conversations with employees to try and frame deals or offers in a stronger way.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, that point around what will we see in terms of senior exec performance, you know, because at the moment, a lot of people will be saying, we've brought them in their top level. We shouldn't have to do that in a way. It'd be really interesting to see how the trend goes on that, whether actually people continue with that and accept that every so often they may have to make pretty sizable payouts, or whether actually that changes and people start to expect that performance management just more as a matter of course. Katie, I just want to touch on employment tribunals. Mm-hmm. And if you get to tribunal, where do you think you're going to land in terms of, I'm just thinking again with those high risk dismissals where you could be looking at really long, you know, future losses. Mm-hmm. We might already have had a delay. So we've already had, I mean, where do you think we'll go in terms of evidence and sort of proving what the loss might be with a bit more accuracy?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think that's going to be a really important and interesting area, because I think it's probably fair to say that to date, there hasn't been as much focus on mitigation evidence in some tribunal claims as there might have been from the sort of party's perspective, certainly sort of earlier in the process. But I think that focus on having the evidence to show what roles were out there, what roles are that out there, and potentially even sort of expert evidence in terms of sort of sector specifics, so labour market expert evidence on what kind of roles would have been appropriate and someone could have gone for. I absolutely don't think that's going to be relevant in every case, but I think in these high value cases, it is going to be something that, A, you're going to need to think about that expert evidence perhaps sort of further into the claim, and B, right at the outset, you don't want to be really on it with your mitigation evidence, and have a think about, is that something that you within the employer business are best placed to be keeping a track on? Or is it something that you want perhaps your recruiters, people, if you work with recruiters, are they going to be able to say, well, we can help with this and give you a good track on these types of vacancies? So it's just having a think about who's going to be best placed to think about and sort of do those searches.
Yeah, because it's very different, isn't it? Just to your normal, to a sort of a repeat run on what's coming up on Indeed for your, you know, less senior people, which you might do ordinarily at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. They're much more complex, aren't they? Yeah. So what roles might be out there? They might not be on the.
Well, they don't tend to be just advertised, do they?
It's just having to think about who is best placed to find that information and where it's going to be.
And also thinking about that right from the start.
Yes.
So if you don't think you're going to be able to do a deal, getting that evidence trail lined up right from the start is going to be really difficult.
Yeah,
it's going to be hard to retrofit it, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think that's where then we're going to see a real change, that we probably have that now retrospectively.
Yeah.
Whereas I think actually being really on it as soon as you're into the territory of a sort of messy dispute, I think that's going to be really different.
Yeah. So, Katie, we're about to wrap up now, and I don't want to leave people too sad about everything we've talked about. So I just think we've talked about tribunal delays, we've talked about AI, you know, sort of raising people's expectations. But I think there is a point which is worth bearing in mind, which is, to a degree, the tribunal delays, I think, could work in people's favour, which is if you are offered a fair fair settlement, actually, there's going to be a whole raft of people who will say, I'd rather take that money now. It's known money I can have now and I can move on with the rest of my life rather than, waiting to see what their chances are in tribunal in 2, 3, 4 years' time. Who knows? And, you know, the expense and the stress. Let's not forget the stress that goes with that. So I think a little chink, which is that the tribunal delays may help actually with those negotiations if you're offering a fair price. I think the other point, which we've certainly seen, is claimant lawyers are very much on it in terms of the impact of these changes and what they might mean, and, you know, the potential there to push awards up. So it is going to be interesting to see how this develops. Mm-hmm. So thank you both, Luke. Very, very good to have had you as a guest. Katie, I hope you don't feel you didn't get your time in the sun. Never.
Always happy to share it.
Never, absolutely. So I'm just going to end with some sort of top tips to bring this all together. So I think the first one, and I'm pretty sure if we haven't said it for every one of these episodes, Katie, we certainly said it for at least one, which is get your recruitment right. Really spend the time investing. It's that whole, put the time in then and it will save you time, later on down the line if you get your recruitment right across all levels. sharpen up your dismissal processes and your documentation so that actually you have a process to stand behind if the 6 months is passed and you're having to dismiss somebody after that 6 month period, including have a think about your senior executives and how you're going to manage the dismissal process alongside that. Luke, to your point, review contractual documentation, so your service agreements and your remuneration packages, just to see if there's anything you can do to reduce the possible heads of loss, any sort of tweaks you can make to the drafting, should a claim be brought or threatened. Be strategic, I think, about your senior exec exit. So if you think you're going to have to let somebody go, more planning around that exit strategy. You know, assess the risk and how it do you think that person is going to react, devise the best path to follow, which might include, as you said, Luke, adhering to a more formal disciplinary process, something you might not have done in the past. And I think within reason, because I do appreciate that not everybody wants to be a mini lawyer in the making, take some time to understand how a tribunal would calculate loss and compensation so that if somebody comes to you, if they've looked everything up in AI and say, look, I've got a claim here that's worth hundreds of thousands of pounds, you can actually say, no, hang on a minute. That's not how a tribunal would approach these things, regardless of the removal of the cap. So, you know, to just bear all of that in mind. So unless you had any other top tips to add, no, shaking of heads. That is it for this series. Thank you so much for joining us. To see our previous two episodes, do have a look at the Burgess Salmon YouTube channel, or you can also find them via our Employment Rights Act Hub, which is on our website. Meantime, thank you so much for joining. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.